Welcome to The Dig. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from AS220 in Providence, Rhode Island. Donald Trump launched his campaign by calling Mexican immigrants rapists. He also pledged to build a big, fat, beautiful wall on the southern border. That, of course, Mexico is going to pay for. It's no surprise that Trump's message struck a chord. Right-wing nativism has been rising for decades, and hardcore xenophobes took over the Republican Party long before this particular monster entered center stage. Worse yet, so-called immigration moderates on both sides of the aisle, including Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, have sought to placate those reactionary forces by militarizing the border and orchestrating mass deportations. Now that Trump has won the presidency, undocumented immigrants are rightly worried and mobilizing to defend their communities. Before we get started, I want to apologize for the crappy audio quality. Again, it sounds pretty Skype-y. We are here on our third episode, and we are figuring this one out. Thank you. Today, we are joined by two guests who can help us understand where immigration politics are heading in the months to come. Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez is a professor at the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law and the author of the blog Crimmigration. And we have Chris Newman, legal director at the National Day Labor Organizing Network. So this election was about a lot of things, including economic crisis and the never-ending war on terror. But Trump made a point of explaining all of America's problems, real and perceived, through the lens of nativism and xenophobia. Obviously, that narrative that he spun was convincing to a big chunk of the electorate. Cesar, how did we get to this point where Muslims and Mexicans are the leading right-wing explanation for all of the country's problems, and a decent amount of the country finds that explanation convincing?
Yeah, Donald Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail and since then has certainly been much more inflammatory, much more blatantly nativist and explicitly racist than any other politician that has risen to prominence in my lifetime, at least. But it's not entirely disjointed from the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing over the last 25 or 30 years. For much of that period, going back to the mid-1980s, we've seen a fairly consistent strand of rhetoric among prominent politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, that have demonized migrants and created migrants into this picture of lawlessness. They can easily be depicted as dangerous to our communities, to our way of life, and in fact to our very lives themselves. And once we've done that, and that's become, we've allowed that to become the dominant frame through which we view immigrants and immigration, there's a logical next step to then respond with the strong arm tactics that become the norm in the immigration enforcement realm under President Obama and was ramping up under his predecessors, but which we've become accustomed to. And so I think Trump's rhetoric is certainly much more racist and vile than what we have seen in the past, but at least by very prominent politicians. But I don't see it as having come out of nowhere. I think it rises from this trajectory that we've been firmly positioned on as a country and for quite a while now.
Chris, yeah, were you surprised to see such brazen nativism become the center of the presidential campaign?
I would say I was disappointed, but not surprised. And I mean, I absolutely agree with everything Cesar just said. But I think that what I think has gone unnoticed is a deliberate political strategy by the Democratic Party as well to try to, in essence, radicalize the Republican Party on immigration as a mechanism driving voters to the Democrats, through a strategy of motivating them through fear. And I think, frankly, the Frankenstein, in a sense, that was created was more powerful. This notion of a Pied Piper, trying to push the worst, most draconian type of Republican voice as a mechanism of sort of decreasing expectations on the policy sphere and even in the political sphere for the Democrats, it obviously backfired. And I think that Donald Trump occupied political space that was ceded by the Obama administration as part of the strategy. I think it's important that people understand that the administration sort of played both sides on the immigration debate for the last 8 years. And as long as they were able to sort of suspend the disbelief of their beliefs that they were trying for an omnibus comprehensive immigration reform bill, that was then used as an excuse for them to engage in pretty dastardly policy and even politics that started to open the terrain for the criminalization of immigrants through policy and discourse, which again I think was in essence a baton that Donald Trump took and ran with. And I think that the clearly the administration's plan of keeping immigration reform in abeyance as sort of an issue that they could use for the next election didn't work out. And in many ways, I think that they underestimated the threat, both in the United States and people have commented on this whole notion of the global of neo-nationalism, which is occurring. This is not something that just happened in the United States. You can look across as the nativists do to Europe and the assault on multiculturalism that's taking place there as something that also portended the rise of Trump.
Chris, can you go into a little bit more in some detail about Obama's record on immigration? I think a lot of liberal supporters of Obama might not be aware how similar some of his policies are to those that Trump, despite the brazenness of his racism, has pledged to pursue.
Well, I mean, and I think Cesar might be a better person to comment on the historical record. Clearly, I have a position. I work for an advocacy organization. I think we were one of the immigrant rights organizations to break ranks with the Obama administration in 2008. And actually, that occurred when the president appointed Janet Napolitano as his Secretary of Homeland Security. And people need to know that Janet Napolitano's position on immigration right around 2008 in many ways was more punitive toward immigrants than even George W. Bush's. Janet Napolitano came from having received the endorsement of Arpaio for when she ran for governor. She helped lobby for Joe Arpaio's deputized enforcement authority, the so-called 287G enforcement authority, which started his reign and again kind of portended in some ways also the rise of Trump. And so the signal that was sent early by the Obama administration by putting Janet Napolitano at the top was ominous to those of us who had been working with migrants in Arizona for years, and we knew full well that she philosophically believed in using police and sheriffs as so-called force multipliers for federal immigration enforcement, and which of course multiplied the force of some of the injustices that we've seen in terms of the broken and out of control and over criminalizing criminal justice system. And so very early on, our organization was involved in opposing many of the administrative proposals that the administration and Janet Napolitano had, and quite specifically having to do with the role of police and sheriffs in the enforcement of immigration law. I think people maybe know, but necessarily stop to appreciate the fact that President Obama has deported more people than I think any president in history. And I don't know what the total number is now, well over 2 million people who were deported by President Obama and his administration. And early in the administration, when some of the ramped up enforcement occurred, there was an argument that was proffered by White House aligned organizations and those in Democratic Party leadership that sort of ahead of enforcement was necessary to build up the credentials for the Obama administration to even have a discussion about doing a comprehensive immigration reform bill that legalized the undocumented population, which is the shared hierarchy of immigrant rights organizations throughout the country. And so there was a sense among immigrant rights advocates that some of these nasty enforcement policies would have to be swallowed as a priority to even lay the groundwork for an immigration reform bill. And allowed sort of that posture allowed the administration to play, in a sense, both sides. They got to the Tea Party and to the nativists, say, look, all the things that we're doing in terms of record removals, in terms of getting police involved, and to the immigrant rights community, they said, look, you know, this is necessary as part of a gambit to fix the whole thing legislatively. And then when the table got set for the legislative, the Obama administration had put itself in a win-win position where either they got the policy if they won the legislation, or they got the politics, they got the issue. If they lost it, because they have now moved the debate so far to the right, they would be able to blame the Republicans for impeding progress. And this is a strategy that for them politically. There was a narrative after the 2012 election when Romney lost that immigration was somehow the issue that prevented him from winning. And again, I think that the administration sort of was again playing both sides, all the while engaging in building an enforcement record that I think history will not look kindly. And in particular, again, and then this is an issue I imagine we'll explore in more detail, this idea of revolutionizing the balance or the division of labor between local police and sheriffs and federal immigration law enforcement is something that I think, you know, really did give rise to Donald Trump and the type of criminalizing rhetoric that we saw throughout his campaign.
Cesar, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the characteristics of the Obama administration's immigration enforcement policies. How that and there are a few strands that I think for me have been extremely palpable. One is the enormous detention network that President Obama has presided over. We now have more people detained every year while they're waiting to find out whether they're going to be allowed to remain in the United States or not. Then we have in most of the history of the United States, with the exception of Japanese internment, although most of those folks weren't actually facing the possibility of deportation. And at the point that we're trying to figure out whether or not the current immigration enforcement practice is larger than Japanese internment, we should already pause and reflect on the sorry state of affairs. But I think it helps us to contextualize that practice by linking it to some of the political rhetoric that made it normal for the United States to use detention as a means of enforcing immigration law. Historically, we didn't do that. There are some major exceptions in the context of the Chinese exclusion, with folks being detained on Angel Island in the San Francisco Bay. But by and large, by the mid-20th century, we had abolished immigration imprisonment, and that the modern use of immigration imprisonment resumes in the early 1980s when we start seeing that there are a lot of Cubans who are leaving the island from the port of Mariel, folks who were described pejoratively as Marielitos, and most importantly to this conversation, they were depicted as being the cast-off Castro's prisons. There was a U.S. News and World Report headline. You have to remember, in the early 1980s, U.S. News was actually a source of journalism, not just a rank service for high school students trying to figure out where to go to college. And at the time, U.S. News published this article that was titled "Castro's Crime Bomb in the U.S." And it had a photo. It was accompanied by a photograph of a couple of folks who were supposedly people who been to left from Mariel. And where were they? They were sitting inside of a federal prison in Georgia. Why were they there? Because they dared to come to the United States in violation of immigration law, and they had been depicted as being criminals, as being dangerous in the popular media at the time, in the dominant political rhetoric. And so it became almost inevitable that the federal government would respond by throwing them in jail. This is where you put people who are dangerous. This is where we put people who are criminals. And we see very similar rhetoric embraced wholeheartedly by the administration. He famously described President Obama famously described his administration's immigration policies as focused on, quote, felons, not family members. He goes to felons, not families. He goes on to say he's focusing on gang members and criminals and not mothers and children. But that rhetoric is far removed from the reality. We can see today that there are in fact mothers who are detained by barbed wire. There are in fact children who are detained behind barbed wire. And his administration very skillfully uses that rhetoric of migrant criminality as the justification for these strong arm tactics that we see originate under President Reagan. And we move forward, we see adopted just as wholeheartedly by candidate Trump, and only assume that President Trump is going to take a similar approach given his recent comments about either deporting or incarcerating immigrants and his decision to surround himself by such hardline figures as Jeff Sessions, who he hopes to point to head the Justice Department.
On the face of it, you have Obama saying felons, not families, and Trump saying all immigrants are criminals. It seems different. But Cesar, doesn't one just slip into the other?
I'm not sure that I agree with your premise that those are distinct analyses. They're definitely analyses that are were articulated by different people. And I certainly would agree that Trump's articulation was more uncouth, impolitic, more abrasive. But that is a superficial difference. In their substance, there is a whole lot more similarity between those two framings than there are differences. At the point that President Obama lodges the felon label onto the folks who he has deployed the massive immigration enforcement apparatus that currently exists in the United States, unprecedented in the history of the country, he understands, because he's an intelligent individual, and because he's saying this, I think this was about 6 years into his presidency, that the reality of his enforcement practices that are occurring under his watch are not limited to people who are actually dangerous, are not limited to people who are engaging in violence. He understands, or he should have at least understood, that throwing that label around so loosely, that felon label, suggests to his audience, the American people and the world community, that in fact he is focused on people who are endangering the United States and endangering community members in the United States. And he should have understood that is not what was actually happening. And that in wielding this enforcement apparatus that includes 20 ICE officers and 20,000 Border Patrol officers, there are no shortage of people who are far from the felon category, are far from the dangerousness label that are being picked up by his enforcement his enforcement agents. I think we have to take a critical view of President Obama's legacy because it sets the tone and sets the foundation for whatever immigration enforcement apparatus Trump wants to throw into overdrive, as he has promised.
Chris, speaking of that apparatus, we've been talking about how Obama, just as Bush and Clinton politically laid the groundwork for Trump's rise. But what institutionally, structurally, tell me about the deportation machinery that Obama has helped to construct that he will soon be handing off to President Trump.
Very early on, the Obama administration made, I think, a huge error in allowing the Secure Communities Deportation Program to be sort of the centerpiece of its immigration and enforcement strategy. In the first major speech that Janet Napolitano gave after going to Washington, D.C., she gave a speech on the one-year anniversary of a program that was piloted under the Bush administration, the Secure Communities Program, which enlisted local police and sheriffs as force multipliers to extend the reach of immigration enforcement activity. And in Secretary Napolitano's first speech, she embellished the success of the program by actually sharing a number of factually inaccurate comments about sort of the she said murders, rapists, and arsonists had captured. When she gave that speech, it was something that caught our attention, in part again because we knew of Napolitano's bad record with Joe Arpaio in Phoenix. And the administration really sort of, in a sense, bet the farm on this policy where they forced all jurisdictions in the United States eventually. It's a long story of how we got there. But basically every single person who's fingerprinted in the United States in a jail has those fingerprints shared not only with the FBI, but also with the Department of Homeland Security. And that program has really been a disaster for reasons that you and others have written about.
After Obama orchestrated record deportations in significant part through secure communities and purportedly, though not in reality, focusing on serious criminals, organizations like yours, Chris, and Dreamers and other grassroots immigrant rights activists mounted a successful campaign to push the Obama administration to take executive action to protect Dreamers, young people brought to the country undocumented as children from deportation. Roughly 700,000, I think a little over 700,000, are currently protected by the program. Trump has in the past stated that he opposes Obama's executive actions on immigration, but has recently, in his typically opaque manner, suggested that he might be amenable to something different. What have you two heard, and what do you believe might happen with DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals?
Among the many things I think about this moment, people have commented about this, the post-truth society, and people are worried about the fascist inclinations of Donald Trump. But among, I think there's lots of uncertainty, but no one can predict, I think, is what will come next and what the Trump administration may or may not do. What I think is fascinating, though, is that there's now an understanding that I think is being galvanized, particularly in Washington, D.C., that Trump intends to sort of use the interests of the so-called Dreamers against the interests of the so-called criminals that he will be enforcement action against. And to be blunt, that's essentially what the Obama administration did as well. The Obama administration on some level, with the Dreamers, is, you know, the good news is we won't deport anybody, unless they're a criminal, or we won't deport. But the bad news is everyone's potentially a criminal now, except for the Dreamers. And I think that there's a worry that the Trump administration will simply do more of that, more of the same, sort of more, potentially on sort of both sides, and that will put rights activists in a tricky place, and it'll put Dreamers in particular in a particularly terrible place, where somehow extension of actions for them become a bargaining chip for the criminalization of others. That's a familiar dichotomy. Again, it was a dichotomy that existed within the Obama administration, and it is maybe just more visible now, or the threat more visible with Trump and his racist rhetoric and his core of base supporters who themselves, in many cases, are the white nationalists.
If I could jump in here, I think this is a rhetoric that is certainly likely to emanate from the White House and President Trump, but it is also something that we've seen reiterated by prominent Democrats in Congress, including, I'm thinking specifically of Durbin, the U.S. Senator from Illinois, articulated justice, this depiction of Dreamers as being the highly sympathetic, highly motivated people who want here, as we should, but framing them in opposition to the bad immigrants, so-called bad immigrants, that we shouldn't think of as sympathetic, and he's done so as recently as this December, when describing some of his negotiations, his conversations with Senator Lindsey Graham about trying to push through legislation in Congress to protect DACA recipients from possible enforcement actions. President Trump, and so I think that there is that concern that advocates and that immigrants have lived with for 8 years under President Obama, in which the good immigrants are pitted against the bad immigrants, is very real moving forward. I'm hopeful, though, that we as a community, as a political community, have learned from that and noted that the line between a criminal and somebody who's not a criminal is actually quite blurry. It often has nothing to do with morality and everything to do with privilege. One of the things that President Obama is that the federal government has ramped up the number of prosecutions for federal immigration crimes. Most of these immigration crimes consist of coming into the United States without the federal government's permission, or doing that after having previously been deported. That is, you violated immigration law. Those people get prosecuted, they get convicted, they get imprisoned after conviction. And so they are, by any formal definition of the term, well, they are criminals. If we define that word to mean somebody who's been convicted of a crime, some versions of that crime are felonies, some are misdemeanors, and so you can just accurately describe them from a legal sense. You can accurately describe them as felons, as federal felons. And if you don't unpack who you're talking about or what they did, then you just end the conversation there, and you just think of them as bad people who we don't want in the United States. But in reality, there are people who are doing what generations of migrants have done in the past, which is coming to the United States and not being stopped by legal prohibitions to do so. And yet this framing of good immigrants versus bad immigrants It doesn't accept that nuance. It also doesn't accept the nuance that many of us commit crimes that are not investigated, that are not prosecuted, and that therefore don't lead to convictions. I work on college campuses, and I'm well aware of the fact that on almost every campus in the United States, drug use is common. Marijuana use is extremely common, not just here in Colorado, where it's now legal under state law and has been for several years, but throughout the United States. This is not news to anyone who ever spent any amount of time on the college campuses. You can smell your way to a federal crime on a Friday night or Saturday night. So similarly, sex assaults are endemic on college campuses. The rates of women in particular who are sexually abused are shameful. And yet, the vast majority of those crimes, whether it's the low level drug offenses or the serious sexual assaults, are not investigated. And they're not prosecuted, and their perpetrators are not convicted of crimes, and therefore they don't become labeled criminals and they're not stigmatized as criminals. But it's not because they're better people than those who are labeled criminals. It's that they have the great privilege of engaging in their criminal activity in privileged spaces, as in spaces that are dominated by wealthy or upper middle class white people, and therefore the police don't enforce laws nearly as vigorously as is happening throughout communities in the United States. And so the people who are perpetrating those crimes on college campuses and college dorm rooms every single week are not being stigmatized and not being demonized in the way that it is easy to do with immigrants or with folks who are living in communities of color throughout the United States.
No, I mean, I think Cesar is quite right. I think that this, you know, there, and I'm hopeful that not only is there now greater scrutiny onto this, you know, dichotomy between the so-called deserving and undeserving immigrant, but I also hope that we will engage in a more sophisticated interrogation of the trajectory that immigration policy has had since this country's, you know, inception. Of fostering and furthering white supremacy and, in fact, engaging in you know, racializing policies since the founding documents. In other words, it's not just the sort of deserving and undeserving immigrant. It's also the idea of punishing and excluding some people as a means of legitimizing the presence of citizens who themselves could have, you know, entry into the United States questioned as illegal. And, you know, the founding documents of the country obviously legalized white men to, you know, to the exclusion and to the sort of specific criminalization of others, and in many ways, you know, the sort of nationalist impulse that has undergirded the imagined community that is the United States has contemplated, you know, defining in order to also define the winners and to increase the value of membership in the polity that is the United States. And so I hope that you know, if there's one benefit of now seeing this unrestrained racist discourse, and I think what we're going to see are pretty horrific policies that come leading the dreamers to the side. I think the hope will be that will allow like I said, a more sophisticated understanding. It's something that gets us out of the thumb of the political gamesmanship that had this issue in people's lives in abeyance the last 15 years. And we're already starting to see that in places, not just, you know, in campuses where we're seeing, I think, sort of more emboldened statements of defense of rights, but also in some of the immigrant dense cities and states like here in California, you know, in a weird and ironic way, the range of policy choices hopefully will be wider and will allow for the immigrant rights movement, which has emerged in the last 10 years, primarily in support of a legislative policy. Hopefully it will mature into a force that has a meaningful alignment with progressive causes, including those that are fighting for racial justice, for criminal justice reform, human rights, and others. And so this is really, I think, hopefully, to put a hopeful moment, an inflection point where the bad range of options that had previously been given to immigrant rights groups will now yield way to a greater, depth and sophistication and ability of how immigrants can be protagonists for reform.
That's a very good point, and I would add the fight for economic justice to that list, because looking back through history, it seems that two key moments that lead us to where we are today is, one, the beginning of wage stagnation and growing inequality in the late 1970s, and then two, the 1965 changes to immigration law, which led to a much more diverse group of immigrants coming to the country. And looking back over the years, the unemployment rate tacks very neatly with hostility towards immigrants in this country. And it seems like there's been a pretty noxious combination or to put it better, that the long-running economic crisis in this country has been very deftly exploited by the xenophobic right.
Yeah, I think you're right in that, you're correct in that the late 20th century changes to the way that the economic wealth is distributed and the demographic changes spurred by immigration are able to be paired in a way that then imbues nativist passions is accurate. But I think actually that foundation is set much earlier. Set actually with the original sin of the U.S. legal tradition, which is its embrace of slavery, and the slavery as meaning the chattel slavery is being a commodification of human bondage and of a certain racial group. It's in that moment when race and class are themselves wielded in a powerful foundational sense to produce an association between blackness and criminality, from which we've never really parted ways. It has changed in some forms. That association between blackness and criminality has changed in some forms. It's broadened to include folks who are others, as outsiders in different ways, and simply being enslaved Africans or their descendants. But that association between race and danger hasn't gone away in political discourse, and hasn't gone away in law. So when we experience these economic shifts and these graphic shifts in the late 20th century, those changes aren't looking around for something in which to ground themselves. They are immediately anchored in this pre-existing fear of people of color and a pre-existing willingness to exploit the labor of marginalized people to benefit white supremacy and to promote and to retain white supremacy. And what Donald Trump has done is he has ripped away the curtain that suggested that we're moving beyond that, and reminded us that actually progress that has been made and that will throughout the late 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, we are still very much anchored in that reality that we embraced so explicitly over 200 years ago, and are still struggling to figure out how to move on, and in fact struggling to figure out whether we want to move on or not as a nation.
Well, in less than 200 years, 100 years ago, established whiteness to even naturalize, And in the United States, I think people don't, you know, aren't aware of some of that history as well. And then it isn't just exactly immigration policy has in fact been race constructing along the way as well.
Zooming back to the awful present from the terrible past, Trump has made big nominations that will have a major impact on immigration. Senator Jeff Sessions, one of the leading nativist voices in Congress for Attorney General, and retired General John Kelly, who as head of the U.S. Southern Command fear-mongered over the terrorist threat at the Mexican border to head the Department of Homeland Security. According to Fox News, which is, I think, a reliable source on this matter, immigration hawks are cheering the appointments. What should we expect from these two nominees?
Well, people have remarked that progressives took the rise of Trump literally, or people have remarked on the left that I'll start from the beginning. Some people have commented that progressives, as Trump was rising, took him literally but not seriously, and his supporters him seriously but not literally. And I think at this point, given that he's about to take control of the executive branch of the government, we have to, certainly in the immigrant advocacy community, take him both literally and seriously. And the thing that he's saying, I think, again, he's signaling that he might be in some type of deal-making in ways that people will speculate about. And of course, but I think we have to take his promises to create a deportation force to militarize the border and other things seriously. And certainly General Kelly has been sort of part of the club of people that under imagined threats along the southern border and created these phantom threat scenarios to justify military and police action. And so I think we have to prepare for the worst. I think we have to prepare for a person who will be heading the Department of Justice who has spent his entire career in direct opposition to the civil rights movement up to, you know, the current day. I think I think there's a fear that people like Chris Kobach, the author of SB 1070 in Arizona, will be in positions of authority, and whereas I think many of these people who are the brain trust of the neo-nativist movement in the United States, clearly many of them themselves are white supremacists. If not they themselves, they certainly attract white supremacist supporters, and I think it's fair to say that about them. But it is also fair to say that they are not stupid people. In fact, they have engaged in a sophisticated strategy to try to reduce the presence of the foreign-born population in the United States and to advance the types of policies that we're discussing. Bush, of course, himself is one of the architects of this theory of trying to effectuate a reduction of immigration through attrition, the idea of basically making life so horrible for immigrants, whether they're documented, undocumented, or in between, but making life so tough, denying access to services, basic functions services, rights and benefits, such that life becomes so terrible that they self-deport or leave voluntarily. And so I think that we will come to see a myriad policies that will try to really ramp up an attrition policy that has been in place for the last 15 years. And I think that they will push in the boundaries in a number of contexts, not just border enforcement, detention policy, this idea of conscripting local police as federal deportation agents, which is something that would usually be considered crazy among the right, who are fearful of that kind of expansion of federal government controlling local governments. But in the immigration, they say, let's go for it. I think these people are going to push on a variety of fronts. I think people are concerned about the way in which domestic immigration policy will soon be conflated with militarizing foreign policy along and beyond the southern border. And so the people that Trump have already is already appointed, really, it's quite chilling. And I think, again, it, to those who thought that somehow Trump was going to moderate his position on immigration or defy his base on immigration the way I think pretty much all presidents have in my adult lifetime, it seems like Trump might break rule two and actually seek to please his base on immigration in a way that is quite scary.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to note that Jeff Sessions has been a harsh critic of the Obama administration's immigration enforcement practices, despite the fact that the Obama administration's immigration enforcement practices have been among the most hardline immigration practices of any president in the history of the United States. If Sessions has been a reliable critic, going so far as to claim that the administration isn't enforcing immigration laws, despite the reality, despite as Chris said earlier, the millions upon millions of people who have been deported, despite the fact that we have upwards of 400,000 people every single year who are detained while the federal government decides if they're going to be allowed to remain in the United States, despite the fact that we have about 100,000 people who were booked into the custody of the U.S. service because they were suspected of violating of federal immigration crime. Despite all of those facts, Jeff Sessions has consistently and stridently claimed that the Obama administration has simply been too soft-footed when it comes to immigration. So once he's given the reins over at the Justice Department, I think we would be foolish to assume that he is going to shift gear. One of the things that has become evident about Donald Trump is that he is swayed by his advisors, by the folks who he surrounds himself with. And so I think we need to look at Sessions' track record very closely. And we see that he is consistent. He is consistently promoting restrictionist and nativist policies, and so it would be quite the shock if he were to suddenly change his approach. With General Kelly and his nomination to head the Department of Homeland Security, much has been said about the fact that he is a military man. But here again, I think a little bit of context is helpful. We have to remember that Secretary Jay Johnson, who currently heads the Department of Homeland Security for President Obama, was previously General Counsel of the Department of Defense. He did that in 2009 to 2012, and in a few years earlier, he, under the Clinton administration, so some years earlier in the Clinton administration, he'd been the lead lawyer for the Air Force. He was previously a prosecutor. So he also from a prosecutorial and most importantly a military background. And so it's not having military folks in the Department of Homeland Security is not necessarily unprecedented. But I do think it lends a little bit of an explanation why it is that the Department of Homeland Security has boosted its military appearance, why it is that they rely so heavily on techniques that are developed in the battlefield. For example, they were the first units of the federal government outside of the military to use drones. Same Predator drones that were flown in war zones in Afghanistan and Iraq and recommissioned to fly over the southern border with the United States. These ideas aren't just popping into people's heads out of nowhere. It's their experience. It's what they know. And so they repurpose it for their new jobs. And so I think the history of the Department of Homeland Security's short life should make us wary of putting another military person at its helm, but it's not a surprise that is who Donald Trump has gone with.
One last question for the two of you. There has been a lot of talk around the country about resisting ICE, but a lot of that talk has been short on specifics. What can actually be done in the years to come, whatever it is that Trump decides to do?
You know, one of the things I thought we would talk a little bit more about is the notion of a sanctuary movement, a new sanctuary movement in the United States. Municipal and state governments enact that are protective of recent arrivals and immigrants who are being criminalized. And I think one of the immediate reactions that we've seen as people have worked through the stages of grief and are really, you know, actually now moving to the stage of acceptance that Trump will soon be president of the United States, the policymakers at the local level have now started to move into the action phase and are promulgating policies that will be protective. And I think that that's one thing that will happen and should be encouraged. And I think that there's, again, a big asterisk here and something that might be worthy of some additional conversation about the fact that the existing policies that are derided as sanctuary policies themselves, reaction to President Obama's own policy, and you know, the in fact, I mean, some, you know, have recently been talking about the centrality of the San Francisco policy in particular in potentially, you know, sort of, you know, the being demonized by Trump as he launched his campaign and what had in Trump's rise. But I think that we're quite a bit more of a kind of diffuse policymaking experimentation at the local level that will put a policy in conflict with the intentions and policies of Trump. I also think that this is a time when immigrants and immigrant rights organizations themselves will engage in a more kind of decentralized approach of kind of bottom-up self-help and organizing in our own network, Frente Labor Organizing Network. We have website altotrump.com, which serves as an open source resource for community organizations that are engaged in neighborhood block organizing, frankly, to deal prepare for what lies ahead. And I think in the near term, there will be immigrants and communities that will move from a sense of powerlessness about what's happening in Washington, D.C., a sense of feeling empowered that they can do things to protect their own families, neighborhoods, communities, and local policies. And so I think that's a healthy dynamic that will be encouraged. And I do think that some of these fights, again, will take place in more localized ways. I mean, who will be the next Joe Arpaio that will emerge, that will try to demonize and, in fact, terrorize immigrants at the local level? And how will immigrants region, you know, what, you know, a multi-tiered campaign of advocacy, litigation, electoral to unseat the next Arpaio, on sort of one side of the spectrum. On the other side from there will be places like California, where this week legislation was introduced to completely disentangle ICE from the state criminal justice system, the most far-reaching legislation that I've seen to free ICE out of the police departments, sheriff's departments, jails, and in fact prisons as well. And you know, I think it's fantastic what happened in California this week, is that we've seen a shift, frankly, from policymakers engaged in discussions of which immigrants deserve protections, who are the good immigrants and who are the bad immigrants. And there's been a shift from that type of policy and political inquiry into a conversation about what protections everybody in California deserves. So not who deserves what, but what protections do everyone deserve? And California has evolved in its own thinking. A couple years ago, the Trust Act was winners and losers. The California Values Act, which was introduced by the Senate president in California, has, I think, very good chances of being signed into law, goes way, way, way beyond the protections that were contemplated in the Trust Act, which are already sort of considered kind of, you know, an enemy to the Trump agenda. And so I think that there will be some more of that. There's no question that the prospect of a Trump administration is igniting a kind of new chapter in the legal aid and legal services movement in the United States. Across the country, I think that we'll see municipal investments of resources, lawyers for people who are defending themselves from punishment, expulsion by the Trump administration. And if I could again quickly, you know, digress, that is not something that's new either. The very notion of legal aid and legal services and legal you know, services for indigent people in the States is an idea that was conceived of by immigrants. The first aid was given in the 1800s in New York when German immigrants pooled resources to defend against, you know, evictions and theft of wages, and what has, you know, sort of come to be the legal aid movement in many ways in this country is owed to immigrants engaged in efforts of help and defense of against their periods of sort of unrestrained xenophobia. And so I think that there will be quite a bit more jobs, if you will, for lawyers engaged in deportation defense and criminal defense. And I think that a positive thing. And finally, you know, the thing that I would hope would happen is that some of these voices that have been, you know, gerrymandering the immigration debate in Washington, D.C. For several years and several sort of intermediaries that have allowed, used immigration as a political issue, I hope some of them will step aside in the coming years. And I hope that rather than give marching orders and definition to the field outside of D.C. As they've done for the last 15 years in trying to force a failed comprehensive immigration reform strategy. I hope some of them will now either, you know, step to the take their direction from organizations, unions, workers' centers, civil rights organizations, that have been pursuing an alternate strategy, an alternate course of action outside of Washington, D.C. And I think that's already starting to happen as well. And I think that that's something that will, long run, be beneficial. And you know, I will close by saying that you know, you find hope in having a little bit of a longer event horizon. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of trying to be hopeful for 4 years is difficult. I mean, it's difficult to be anything but pessimistic and even fearful about what Trump is capable of in the next 4 years. But if one thinks a little bit sort of more long term, then the threat of Trump, the unrestrained ugliness of it, potentially will open, I think avenues for more ambitious advocacy. And I can tell you that, you know, my own involvement doing work in support of organizing and active in Arizona over the last 10 years has sort of, you know, I've always thought of Arizona as being kind of a window into the near future of the immigration debate. And you know, you can talk about all the different ways in which that's the case. Well, in 2007, Jorge Arpaio had 6% approval rating in Maricopa County. In 2010, in a poll of primary voters among Democrats, the second most popular politician in the state of Arizona. Then, of course, SB 1070 passed in 2010. You know, I think in some sense, you know, the movement was certainly ignited, galvanized within Arizona and around Arizona to fight back against SB 1070. But back to those days in 2007 when there were day laborers in Phoenix that started campaigning against Arpaio when he did that 86% approval rating. And there was not more than 50 people in all of Phoenix that were responding to what was, I think, it's not flippant to say, you know, sort of tyrannical kind of rule by Arpaio. 10 years later, there was a strategy that you know, used activism, civil disobedience, litigation, electoral work, and Arpaio was defeated. And I don't think Maricopa will ever go back. And I think that much of the kind of politicization of young people in is irreversible. And the new leadership that emerged among immigrants themselves, a lot of these people are going to go on to take good office and engage in, some years down the road. And so I do take some hope that the way in which we're able to respond to the next 4 years, the predicate for a greater kind of turning of the tide, if you will, to the overall trajectory that Cesar was talking about earlier.
That point's well taken. And on the national level, in December 2016, Trump is poised to take office with the majority of the country already disapproving of him. So that's a better position than you guys started out in Arizona.
It back 1932, Justice Brandeis famously described states as laboratories of experimentation in a nation's political system. And Chris just laid out a detailed ground game for how it is that states and cities can experiment in democracy enhancing policies and practices that incorporate immigrants into thriving communities that are present in every part of this country. So I have nothing that I could add to what he just laid out, but I will say that one of the things that makes me hopeful about the future is that in being so bombastic and being so sweeping and generalizing and so overbearing, Donald Trump has actually crystallized for people that the vacuousness of his fiery rhetoric. He is, I think, galvanizing many people who in the past were not mobilizing and who were willing to give the benefit of the doubt to President Obama because President Obama's rhetoric and the reality of his enforcement practices quite frequently differed so dramatically. In, if anything, Trump's rhetoric and his seems to be aligning with a hard line, or it has aligned with a hard line immigration enforcement practice that I imagine we can expect to see become the reality of his administration. And if he is going to continuously demonize migrants as being rapists and cruel and dangerous and posing nothing good and describing entire countries as sending people, none of which are of benefit to the States, as he did recently with the Dominican Republic, that's just over the top. And it's hard to miss how over the top that is. And so I think for me, one additional place to be hopeful is that that's becoming evident to a much group of people than ever true under President Obama. And if that clarity can be, is turned into a strident national opposition to what I imagine will be some fairly severe immigration enforcement practices, then perhaps the nation won't, the communities of the nation won't suffer in the way that I think, the horrible way that I think might happen if people don't mobilize in opposition.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Dig, a podcast dedicated to helping people make sense of the world so that they can change it. We are posting new episodes every week or two. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, Jeffrey Brodsky, and Liza Yeager. Music by Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us on iTunes, where you can subscribe and where you can also leave us a glowing review.
Those iTunes reviews help our ranking, and a good ranking helps put us in front of new listeners. Join us in the new year for interviews with Kianga Yamada Taylor, Donna Murch, Glenn Greenwald, David Dayan, and more.